If you assume that the way that you look at the world is natural and inevitable and all-encompassing, and that everyone else should look at the world exactly like you, that's natural human behavior. We all assume that, and it's totally wrong.
Economists tend to share a common understanding of the world based on what they've learned at school and from other like-minded professionals, and that's okay. But if you really want to tackle the big socioeconomic problems, knowing how societies work will give you an edge.
Anthropologists know that there are many ways to look at the world, and most of the time people who are different from you look at it very differently. And if you don't think about those differences, not only are you robbing yourself of a chance to understand the world in all its glory, but you're also likely to make some terrible mistakes.
Gillian Tett is an anthropologist and has been reporting on economic, financial, political, and social issues for the Financial Times for decades. Her journalism has won some of the most prestigious awards in the industry. She's currently the chair of the editorial board and editor-at-large, U.S., of the Financial Times. In this program, IMF Deputy Secretary Sabine Batia sits down with Gillian Tett to discuss her recent book, Anthrovision, A New Way to See in Business and in Life. The event happened before a live audience during the IMF and World Bank Group spring meetings. You can watch a webcast of the entire event at imf.org.
And a very warm welcome to you, Gillian.
I am delighted to be here. It's usually me asking the questions, not the other way around. So this can be your revenge. It's the economist's revenge.
Uh-oh. So you see, I've let myself in for something. I'm not quite sure what. But Gillian, as you can see from the size of our audience, that people are delighted to have you here. We're all avid readers of your columns in the FT. So thank you. And congratulations on being named Provost of King's College, Cambridge University. And selfishly, we are very pleased you'll continue to write for the FT.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to pinching all of your ideas and recycling them as columns.
Oh, that's
columns. Being a journalist is basically a bit like being a magpie. You go around picking up shiny objects from other people and then, you know, recycling them as columns. So thank you to all of you whose ideas I have pinched over the years.
So, Gillian, the question that is, I think many people in the audience have, and we have an audience here and online, is how did an anthropologist become a financial columnist for the FT? Because the two worlds of anthropology and finance could not be more different from each other, right? So how do you go from studying Amazon tribes to studying Amazon warehouses, as it were?
Well, thank you very much indeed for asking. And in fact, I've been asked that a lot, particularly by baffled bankers who, during the 2008 crisis, would say to me, you know, do you have a PhD in economics or astrophysics or an MBA? And when I said to them, no, I actually have a PhD in anthropology, based on a study of Tajik wedding rituals, you can just see their eyes glazing over. And one of them once said to me, gosh, that all sounds rather hippie, doesn't it? But, you know, in a nutshell, I didn't set out to plan my life on any particular path. I'm a passionate believer in that wonderful idea that Steve Jobs, of all people, advanced in his Stanford commencement speech, where he said, you can't join up the dots of your life looking forward. You can only join them up looking back. And you have to create dots and trust that they will join up. And by that I mean, you know, we live in an era where everyone gets told from a young age, focus, 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 find your passion and just do one thing. And that sometimes can be the worst thing to do, because actually you should try and do different things and connect them. In my case, I was passionately interested in Central Asia. I spent a year of my life in Pakistan doing voluntary work, and then I went to Western China, started my anthropology there, and then ended up in Tajikistan, really because I had languages in my background which were linked to Tajikistan, and went to study Tajik wedding rituals. I was actually looking at the question of how a mountain community in Tajikistan had combined their identities of being Muslim and Soviet, and basically what that meant on the ground in terms of their lived experiences. And wedding rituals were a very useful way to look at that. What happened in my case was I always thought I wanted to be a journalist, didn't think I was interested in economics. The Soviet Union broke up. I was on the ground. I started my career really as a war reporter, because I was, you know, surrounded by turmoil and collapse, and almost nobody else wanted to go to these places or knew how to operate and survive. Became a war reporter, became basically, spent a year of my life as a foreign correspondent covering the breakup of the Soviet Union. Started freelancing for the FT because they were pretty much the only media group that was covering these, you know, far-flung places. The other person who was with me at the time, by the way, was Chrystia Freeland. Mm. We sort of split up the Soviet Union between us, and she did the more civilized bits like Ukraine and Moscow, and I did the rest. and then the FT said to me, well, if you're going to carry on working for us, you have to come back to headquarters and learn about economics. And I went, ugh, how boring. And turned up at the FT and realized I was completely wrong, that like most non-economists, the reason I thought economics was boring was because I didn't understand it and was actually quite scared of the of the jargon. I got put onto the money markets team and tried to treat it really like learning Tajik. You know, said, right, okay, there's these economists have this weird language, these financiers, they have these weird rituals, like big conferences. If I could do this in Tajikistan, I can do it in the economics team. And I can even learn at the feet of the great Pope, Martin Wolf, who has been a wonderful mentor of mine over the years, even though he's still convinced I should have done economics, not anthropology. That's really how it happened.
Yeah.
And I spent the last, you know, 25 years, 30 years of my life trying to draw on my cultural training and cultural background and awareness and combine it with the hardcore economics analysis to just provide a slightly different perspective.
Okay, so you've written a lot about the financial crisis of 2008, and you've written a lot about the culture of Wall Street. Now, fast forward now to the present-day banking turmoil and where it all started in Silicon Valley. With your anthropologist hat on, do you think the culture of Silicon Valley had something to do with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, and especially the way the bank run happened? It happened very quickly, very different from usual bank runs. You didn't have people queuing up outside to withdraw cash, but it all went viral, happened on social media, on chat rooms. So just your thoughts on that, Gillian.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been fascinated by the question of the cultural framework of finance for years. And to be honest, I first used it back in 2005 when I was working on the capital markets team before the financial crisis and went down to a big investment banking conference in Cannes, I think it was, or Nice, which was about securitization, and was very struck the minute I walked into that event by the parallels between a big investment banking conference and a Tajik wedding. Because quite seriously, if you stop and think for a moment, you know, what anthropologists do is try to immerse themselves in cultures that might seem alien or different from ourselves, to really both try and understand how other people think, but then get that sense of detachment from your everyday life to look back at yourself. There's a great phrase in anthropology, a fish can't see water. None of us can see the assumptions that blind us and distort our perception of the world unless we jump out of our fish bowls, go swim with other fish, and then look back. And going into this investment banking conference, what I noticed was that just like a Tajik wedding, what investment banking conferences do is pull together a scattered tribe, essentially enable them to recreate social networks and to recreate a shared worldview that comes to seem so natural, they never even notice it or question it. And in the case of the bankers in 2005, the shared worldview basically was that securitization was a specialist craft that only a tiny proportion of people could understand. It had its own jargon and language, and it was completely detached from real life, i.e. what was happening on the ground. You know, in all the PowerPoints that the bankers put up, they had no faces. It was all abstract, you know, Greek letters and charts and maths. And that wasn't just an accident. It illustrated that actually there was a mentality in finance in 2005 where the financiers were so busy doing financial innovations that they'd kind of almost lost sight of what was at the end of their chain, i.e. real human beings. Or to put it another way, they had a bird's eye view, top-down view, rather than an anthropologist's worm's eye view, bottom-up. And that really mattered, as we later discovered. They couldn't see how cultural patterns on the ground were changing in 2005 around, say, people's attitudes towards mortgages and whether it was culturally acceptable to default on them or not. And that was one reason why they got their model so wrong about default risk and didn't see the subprime crisis coming. Now, if you fast forward to what happened in the recent dramas in March, and we're not calling it a crisis now, I think we're calling it the March Madness, the turmoil. There were many things that happened there which were, you know, really rooted in culture. One of them was the fact that Silicon Valley Bank had this very concentrated depositor base of mostly techies and VC groups, who for the most part were utterly uninterested in finance. You know, most techies in Silicon Valley people think that, you know, bankers are deadly boring and fuddy-duddy establishment, and they'd be sooner be seen dead than think about things like cash management. They want to talk about computer science. So you had a very blind, in some ways naive, depositor base who weren't looking at the risks in Silicon Valley Bank. You had a Silicon Valley Bank management that was actually emulating quite a lot of their own depositors, partly to empathize with them and get good relations. And you put that together and you have this real lack of risk management or awareness going on. And then you look at other issues like the fact that you had this explosion in digital finance, mobile finance, which I think probably is changing consumer behaviors in ways that people have been very slow to look at or actually analyze. And on top of that, you have the tribalism inside the regulatory structures and the economics community. The fact that the Federal Reserve, just like one example, is so detached from a lot of the on-the-ground developments in mobile banking that the Fed's discount window is only open until, I gather, 4 o'clock on East Coast time each day, as if no one had actually noticed that there's such this thing called mobile banking, which is open 24/7. And that's, again, straightforward tribalism, tunnel vision. And the key point is, it's totally natural for every professional group to essentially, have tunnel vision and blinkers because they tend to hang out with people like themselves. And professional groups are defined by having a creation mythology that justifies what they do. And that's true of journalists as well. But the problems come is if you assume that the way that you look at the world is natural and inevitable and all-encompassing, and that everyone else should look at the world exactly like you. Mm-hmm. That's natural human behavior. We all assume that, and it's totally wrong. And at the end of the day, one of the most powerful reasons why anthropology could and should be part of the debate is that anthropologists know that there are many ways to look at the world, and most of the time, people who are different from you look at it very differently. And if you don't think about those differences, not only are you robbing yourself of a chance to understand the world in all its glory and get fresh inspiration, but you're also likely to make some terrible mistakes, as with the bankers in 2005 with their, bird's eye view, as with the people around Silicon Valley Bank who didn't realize the mistakes they were making.
Right. So you've talked about Silicon Valley Bank. So I want to talk about another group of people, and perhaps, and those are people here at our spring meetings. Now, maybe you think our spring meetings are like a Tajik wedding ritual. Not sure.
Yeah, I do completely.
You do? Really?
Yeah. I mean, what you're doing at the spring meetings, I say, is collecting the scattered tribe together, having formal and informal rituals to recreate networks, and above all else, to recreate a shared worldview. And what really matters when you do that is not so much what you talk about on stage, but what you don't talk about. You know, what are the social silences that everyone collectively agrees to ignore because it seems natural that you ignore those issues? Because they're often more revealing than what people do talk about.
Exactly. So just on that point, so there's going to be a lot of discussion on uncertainty, fragmentation, geoeconomic fragmentation, inflation, debt, climate change. So what are we not talking about? What are we missing? I'm sure Kristalina would love to know what you think we're missing.
I would love to. I mean, I do an exercise with everyone and say, what are people not talking about? I mean, I think there are many things that people aren't talking about. One of the things I'm very concerned about is the fact that just, 2 years after the pandemic, it's almost vanished off the conversation on the radar screen. I'm very concerned about microbial resistance, antibiotic resistance. That's not being discussed in any significant way. I mean, one of the other things I'm very concerned about, to pick up a couple of, you know, random ideas, is the issue of, you know, debt. And I just don't see, I mean, to me, the elephant in the room is I do not see how a debt burden that keeps swelling to this degree is going to be paid down mathematically. I mean, what's going to, and if it's not going to be paid down anytime soon, what's going to happen? Are we heading towards financial repression? Are we heading towards inflation? Are we just going to deal with, you know, defaults at some point? I mean, that's another area I think is fascinating right now. Pension crisis, again, doesn't get nearly the attention it needs.
Okay, good. Some points to keep in mind. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion on debt at these meetings. So let's see at the end of the week what comes out of it. But I want to flip the lens a little bit. So you talked about our blind spots. What are the blind spots that you journalists have?
I think the biggest blind spot as a journalist is that we, by value of our craft, assume that having control of language, having mastery of language, enables us to essentially have status and power. You know, that's, you know, we don't get status and power by having lots of money as a journalist. You know, we have it by having control of language and being able to pass ideas quickly and eloquently. That's kind of what we're paid to do. And one of the problems is that we tend to forget that for many people, that doesn't seem inevitable or natural. That just being able to talk makes you extra special or powerful. And if you look at, say, the Donald Trump saga in 2016, I was actually running the American news operation for the FT at that time. And I was on the desk, news desk, when he was doing the debates in the autumn. And there was a very striking moment where he said the word bigly. And everybody on the in the newsroom laughed, including myself, instinctively, because going back to this idea that, you know, what one of us regards as natural is not natural to other people. To a journalist, it's kind of natural to laugh at somebody if they appear to be misusing language when they shouldn't be. And the fact we laughed indicated this kind of mindset amongst the journalists, but it also indicated our collective blindness, because, of course, a large number of people watching that debate amongst the American voters went, he talks just like me. Or, you know, once again, the elites are sneering. And that was quite telling, because I think unless journalists learn to kind of master the 101 of anthropology and try and look at the world through other people's eyes and really listen and learn bottom up and get that worm's eye view, we are at risk of simply replicating some of the mistakes of the people that we're writing about who try and run the world or run things. And we saw that in 2016 very clearly.
Right. So, in fact, just on that point, I want to ask you about the impact of social media and silos. So,
can I? Sorry, and one of the quick things, which is very important, is the other thing I think about the media, I think is difficult, is that we as journalists are trying to shy away from issues and topics that seem geeky and complex and boring and dull. And this really matters because, in fact, often the most important things in the world are the geeky, complex, boring and dull things that are moving slowly. So journalism tends to jump onto stories that are dramatic and which are basically step change events, where you have clear-cut numbers, you have people who say things on the record, and you have drama. And sometimes the really important stories in life are like that. Quite often they're not. So the slow burn wave of financial innovation before 2007, which was not sexy or exciting, but really ended up mattering in terms of all the creation of CDOs and CDS. That was ignored because it seemed complex and geeky and dull. There have been aspects of climate change and other big shifts in the underlying tectonic plates of the global political economy, which again have been slow burning, but tend to get ignored.
Right. So just on the question of silos and social media, so just as you were talking about journalists and, you know, not understanding the other point of view, you know, people are increasingly in the echo chambers, right? And it's not just Gen Z on social media, it's all of us, right? So how, I mean, and we have a very difficult time talking with people who think very differently from us. So how do we, which has profound implications on politics, society, economics, So how do we actually listen to others whose views are orthogonal to ours?
It's really tough because it requires humility. And obviously, if you spent years getting flashy degrees or climbing up the slippery slope of some bureaucracy in a university or in a media, you know, group, or in, you know, a big, you know, MDB or something like that, you know, you begin to think, hey, you know, I've got the answers, I know what I'm doing. And of course, you do in some ways. So actually getting the humility to stop and listen openly with a really open mind to someone else who's completely different from you, who may be not just using different language, but different linguistic framings or different types of epistemology, that's really tough. And I know that myself. You know, in 2016, I, like most globalized professional people from the UK who were traveling around the world, assumed that it was so obvious that Brexit was a really dumb idea that it couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And it never even occurred to me that Brexit might happen. And that's directly a reflection of my arrogance and my failure to listen. And it was a huge shock when the vote went the way it did. And it was an even bigger shock when I discovered that my own father had voted for Brexit. And I think he kind of regrets it now, but hey, that might be my arrogance again. Maybe I'm wrong again. But that was a real slap in the face for me. And boy, did Brexit indicate that most people in this room are in danger of falling into the same trap of me, of not actually trying to do the 101 anthropology of taking off all of your blinkers and lenses and acting, you know, as an anthropologist, almost like a baby going into a different situation and just listening and learning and absorbing. So, you know, the humility is one thing. The other problem, of course, very big problem, is time. Because, you know, we all live in jobs that are incredibly busy. Mm. Most of the big mistakes in life, most of the time people succumb to tunnel vision, is not because they're evil and arrogant or stupid. It's because they're just darn busy and they're scurrying around in their own little professional silo. And they just don't have time to go out and roam and collide with the unexpected. And that, to my mind, again, for myself, is one of the biggest challenges.
Right, right. So you wrote a lot about tunnel vision and lateral vision in your book, your earlier book, The Silo Effect. And you yourself have written about, you know, economists sometimes, and we're mostly economists here, of looking at
problems. I love economists.
Yeah.
Even though I'm an anthropologist.
Of looking at things somewhat narrowly based on their models and assumptions, mm-hmm. right? So we at the IMF have tried to broaden our vision. So we've started looking at climate change, something that's close to your heart, I know, gender inequality. But some would argue that too much of this lateral thinking will blunt our edge, we lose our core expertise. So how do we sort of keep our edge, broaden our focus? Because that's a real tough one.
I completely agree and I totally understand. And I'll say really two or three points. Firstly, my critical comments about economics in the last, you know, 10, 20 years have not been about all economics or let alone all economists, because I have huge respect for the discipline. It's really about the issue that if you look at the world through the lens of a narrow economic model, which certainly became very fashionable in the late 20th century, or I should say through the lens of a narrow corporate balance sheet of the sort that, you know, Milton Friedman said people should only focus on, you end up basically missing everything that's off the balance sheet, out of the model. And if the world is stable, then that may not matter. But we don't live in a stable world today. Things are changing around us all and around the models. And, you know, the image I use sometimes is if you rely just on an economic model to try and navigate with, you're like somebody walking through a dark wood at night with a compass, mm-hmm. and your compass may be technically brilliant, and you don't want to throw your compass away. But if you just look down at your dial all the time as you walk through the wood, you're going to walk into a tree or trip over a tree root and bang your head. And the same way, you don't want to throw your models away or your balance sheet, but you have to look at it in context and see what's beyond the model. What are the assumptions? What is left out? And it so happens in the last 10 years, all the stuff that's been left out, like the environment, like medical risk, like social tensions, like the impact of technology on consumer behavior. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff that used to be in the footnotes of the corporate balance sheet or, you know, an externality to the models, that's become, in many ways, the most important thing. So what I'm arguing for is not rip up economic models. I'm not even arguing that one should spend most of your time looking at the things beyond the balance sheet or beyond the economic models, but you need to be aware of it. And one of the things I constantly say is that I'm not arguing in any way, shape or form that anthropology has the answers. Mm-hmm. You know, anthropology, like all disciplines, has enormous flaws, which I can talk about, but you're mostly not anthropologists, so you probably don't care. But anthropology as discipline is flawed. But anthropology plus economics can be a really powerful way to have checks and balances and to simply get more than one perspective, because all the intellectual tools we use to navigate the world with are flawed, and the only way to cope with these flaws is to have more than one tool to get that difference of perspective.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit more on climate and your on ESG, environment, sustainability, governance. You have your newsletter, Moral Money. And we're seeing recently there's a big backlash against ESG. You know, mm-hmm. some people argue it's sort of woke capitalism.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that?
I have very strong feelings on this. I mean, first of all, I expected a backlash from the moment that we started Moral Money 3.5 years ago. Because guess what? You know, I grew up studying, you know, Hegel, you know, Hegelian dialectic. You know, the pendulum swings one way, you can bet your bottom dollar it will swing the other way, and you hope that at the end of the day you meet in the middle. Why is a backlash happening now? It's partly because of the energy crisis, obviously, and the fact that there hasn't been enough discussion in the world of ESG about trade-offs. You know, for a while back in 2019, people were presenting ESG as this magical wand which could have fantastic returns, save the planet, and there'd be no trade-offs. And the reality is there are trade-offs. And anyone involved in the sustainability movement needs to stand up and say that openly and talk about the trade-offs, because there are trade-offs if you ignore sustainability. And the energy crisis is one area where there have been trade-offs that have not been discussed. Another reason for the backlash is obviously, you know, the fact you have the right wing in America who are looking for something, anything that they can seize on, you know, and basically use to attack the progressives. And another reason for the backlash is that there are elements of the ESG framework that are immature and problematic. They could and should be reformed. They are being reformed, but they are problematic.
What sort of?
Like, for example, it's questionable in my mind whether you should put E and S together. There's been a lack of clarity about whether you're talking about inputs or outputs. Mm-hmm. Are you measuring what companies are doing to the world or what the world does to companies? Mm-hmm. You know, these are some of the trade-offs. However, I would turn it round to anyone who says, I hate ESG, it should be, you know, banned, or I, you know, it's all woke capitalism. And I'd say really two things. Firstly, I passionately believe that if Milton Friedman was alive today, he would actually be talking about stakeholder capitalism as well, because if you want to protect shareholders in today's world, it's really important to think about the context. Because Milton Friedman developed his ideas about shareholder-only capitalism when there were three things happening in the mid-20th century which are not applying today. Firstly, post-World War II, people in the West thought that governments could solve problems. They were the people to do climate change and to do social issues. And today the population doesn't trust governments to do that. Secondly, he was operating in a time when there was great respect for authority and hierarchical authority patterns rather than respect for the crowd. And today people don't really trust CEOs to have, you know, I mean, it sounds contradictory, but, you know, there isn't the same level of respect. But thirdly, most critically, Milton Friedman was writing his ideas at a time when no one had a clue what was happening inside companies, because they were very opaque and you couldn't track them day in, day out. And today, courtesy of all the NGOs who are buzzing around in Washington this week with all their smartphones and satellites and everything else, you have constant tracking of companies and radical transparency, you know, whether it's Glassdoor, whether it's Al Gore's satellites tracking emissions or whatever. So the public can see what's happening and the public can rally when they don't like it. So if a CEO wants to ignore ESG and go in the face of, you know, public opinion, they risk, you know, having reputational problems, losing employees, customers, investors, etc. So if you don't like ESG, you need to say, well, okay, what about a world of radical transparency where populations are looking to companies to get involved as well as governments in solving problems? And you also need to say, well, if you don't like ESG, what do you want instead? Do you actually think you could go back to pure 1970s style Milton Friedman? Because almost nobody I've heard on the right who's saying that I want to go back to, you know, want to attack ESG is talking about going back to Milton Friedman. So then you have to say, well, what else? And I've yet to hear anybody present a very clear answer to that. I would say it's really about embracing what I call lateral vision, looking beyond the balance sheet, beyond the model, not tunnel vision, and maybe talking about, you know, cleaner capitalism or a lateral vision towards looking at business and finance and economics today. Can I just say two things quickly, which is, firstly, when I started my career as a financial journalist in 1993, I was, as I said, originally in the economics room and of the FT, or the economics team. And I used to joke back then that if I found two women to quote in a week, I had to be really careful not to put them in the same article, because then I would have used up my ration of women that I knew who worked in economics. Because in the City of London in those days, there just weren't that many senior women around. You know, there was Margaret Thatcher, and then, well, Margaret Thatcher. But, you know, there really weren't a lot of, you know, and people would say to me, do you have a mentor? Or, you know, now they say to me, did you have a mentor? And the answer is no, I didn't, because the FT reflected the society and the world that it covered, and there were very, almost no senior women at all. And it's really amazing that here we are sitting on the panel with three women. And sometimes the most important changes in life, you know, happen very slowly and steadily over many years, and you can't really see them. But it really is remarkable how it has changed today. And I do believe strongly in the demonstration effect of that. So I'd like to commend Christina and the rest of the, you know, fund for doing that, because it's very, very, you know, striking. And the second thing I'd say is that before 2008, the idea of inviting an unwashed anthropologist onto a stage in the IMF would have seemed almost inconceivable. And again, you know, kudos to all of you for widening that lens and having more of a dialogue and debate. You know, I'm not convinced always that other branches of academia, you know, the anthropologists are necessarily willing to jump in and work and talk to bankers and financiers in their own natural habitat. But it is a sign of progress and change, which I think is very commendable.
Thank you. Thank you. So we are getting more anthrovision, right?
Yeah. More lateral vision. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to end. Thank you very much, Gillian. Thank you for joining us. It's been great chatting with you. Thank you.
That was IMF Deputy Secretary Sabina Bhatia speaking with Gillian Tett before a live audience during the IMF and World Bank Group spring meetings. You'll find a webcast of the entire event at imf.org. Gillian Tett's latest book is Anthrovision, A New Way to See in Business and in Life, published by Simon & Schuster. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.